trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there. Yes, indeed. Once again, here I stand, shovel in hand, ready to shovel truth and light in the direction of anybody who's looking for such things. Hey, I'm glad you're part of my audience today. Got some great audience, great sponsors, and great audience. But it's the sponsors who help to keep the lights on here and make it possible for me to do what I'm doing. They include Govern Your Crypto, also the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage, LifesavingFood.com, MonticelloCollege.org, SewingAndQuiltingCenter.com, HSLAmmo.com, and DixieChiropractic.com. So I'm gonna dive right into what may be the most controversial topic of the week, because it has to do with vaccines. Ooh, I know, that's like the third rail. You got to be so careful in even mentioning such a thing, because that's what all the algorithms are targeted towards. If somebody sees a word, oh, that's a little fact checker say, we don't want people thinking that, and there's probably more to it. So let's talk for a minute, though, about some of the data that Pfizer grudgingly released. And I'll admit, I've only followed this on the periphery, so this has not been the deep dive that I've been digging into every single day. But if the data that I'm seeing is correct, and if what I'm seeing is, well, if it's indicative of some of the damage done, we got a real problem. And in particular, I'm concerned. I saw this yesterday. This is from the Pfizer report, and it's a description of adverse event reports. Pfizer vaxxed 238 pregnant women. Only one of those women gave birth. And the person who posted this says, look, now we know why they wanted to keep the data hidden for 75 years. So, I mean, that sounds pretty damning, you know, and I'm not going to pretend it. That's the whole story right there. But does that not add at least another layer of questions as to, okay, how safely was this vaccine tested? The answer is it really wasn't tested. And because of that, maybe all of that official pressure, which started out as just, you know, asking, hey, would you please consider, hey, I'll bribe you. Would you like $50? Would you like a slice of pizza? You know, all of the things. Would you like to keep your job? Take the shot. You know, I mean, it morphed into such incredible coercion so quickly. And yet, if you're following that data, you know that there are some very serious questions that have been raised. But here's one that comes up, and this is one I'd like to explore, and that is, do the Pfizer data dumps actually mean anything? Kit Knightley, writing for OffGuardian.org, says the latest batch of Pfizer's COVID vaccine files just dropped. 80,000 pages of patient files and trial data and so on and so on. In fact, there's a link. You can click on it and read them all for yourself. All 80,000 pages. Don't read anything less, or I'll know you're not serious. I'm kidding. But Kit Knightley says the question is, do they really tell us anything we don't already know? Now, the big revelation doing the rounds at the minute is that the vaccines were never trialed with and were specifically not recommended for pregnant women. But this new information, well, when government started recommending the COVID vaccine to pregnant women in the summer of 2021, everybody who had been paying attention knew that position was not backed up by any data at all. In fact, OffGuardian.org got temporarily banned from Twitter for pointing this out. Now, more broadly speaking, of course the vaccines were never tested on pregnant women, because they were never properly tested on anybody. It takes 10 years to safely produce and trial a vaccine, not 18 months. And what trials they claim to have done in that year and a half were a complete sham. Kit Knightley says, in a way, the not recommended for pregnant women disclosure is actually good for Pfizer. And behind a facade of being legally mandated to publish these files, now it's become public knowledge that Pfizer allegedly told people, don't give this vaccine to pregnant women. But many countries did it anyway. This shifts the blame and the potential legal liability away from Pfizer and onto the governments in question. So a good example of how forced disclosure can be used to reinforce and direct a narrative through a pretense of reluctance. Going further, shouldn't we be asking, can we trust anything in these documents at all? In other words, just because Pfizer has apparently been legally forced to release them, that doesn't mean they're important, it doesn't mean they're relevant, it doesn't even mean that they're real. Who's verifying the documents? Who's auditing Pfizer to make sure they release everything? The U.S. government or some other government or agency? And then the question is, do you trust them? See, the real damning documents, Kit Knightley says, if such ever existed, have likely been shredded, burned, and buried in 20 feet of concrete now. And that doesn't matter. Here's why. Because we already know everything we will ever need to know about these COVID, in quotation marks, vaccines. Number one, they were not subject to proper long-term testing. Number two, they have totally unknown long-term side effects. Number three, they allegedly treat a disease with a 99.85% survival rate. Number four, they don't prevent infection. Number five, they don't prevent transmission. And finally, number six, the manufacturers are legally protected from being sued in the event they kill you. So the point here is, Pfizer can release all the documents they want. Nothing will change these facts, but only distract from them. I think that's probably a fair way to approach this. I'm not a virologist. I don't understand all the workings of vaccines, and I'm not going to pretend to. But I'll tell you what I'm a pretty good expert on is understanding where my rights begin and how to go about asserting those rights. And when someone is trying to force a medical intervention on me, I don't care how well intended, my right to say no or yes supersedes their right to do whatever is necessary to protect the public, especially in a disease that has, what was it again, a 99.85% survival rate. Remember, that's among people who catch it. Something has felt so off about this from the very beginning. And it started with the masks, and it started with the lockdowns, and then when the vaccines came along. And by the way, there's still plenty of pressure. Well, you know, if you haven't been vaxxed, everybody get out there and get it right now. Now, I know people who've had the vax who have been absolutely fine. And I also know a lot of people who haven't had the vax who've been absolutely fine. And I know people with the vax who've come down with COVID and recovered from it. I know people with the vax who, or without the vax, who've also caught COVID and recovered from it. But the big looming question in my mind always comes back to, by what moral authority does government or some regulatory bureaucracy or some business bureaucracy for that matter, or even some private individual, by what moral authority can they claim the right to use coercion to get someone else to stick a needle in them? See, and I know I'm drawing a hard line here, and I'm with a lot of other people who have as well, but really that's what it comes down to. You either have bodily autonomy or you do not. And isn't it funny? We suddenly rediscovered bodily autonomy all of a sudden. And most of the people who are screaming loudest about how it's my body, it's my choice, these are the same people who are saying, take the shot. Easy there, Alec Baldwin. We'll get around to the shot discussion here in a minute. But I'll have this link here from Kit Knightley's piece in Off Guardian. I would encourage you to take a look at it. Again, there is a link to the 80,000 pages of Pfizer patient files and trial data and so on. I don't have the time or actually the technical knowledge to fully understand and go through them one by one. But just remember, you don't have to be, capable of analyzing every single page to know that these things weren't subject to long-term testing. There's no idea what the long-term side effects are going to be. Although we do seem to have a strange number of blood clots and otherwise healthy people suddenly dropping dead or dying suddenly for no reason at all. We know for a fact that COVID is very survivable for most people, 99% plus of the people who catch it. And we also know that the vaccine doesn't prevent infection. It doesn't prevent transmission. And yet the manufacturers have legal protection that you and I don't have recourse if, for some reason, we die or are otherwise harmed. I mean, it's enough to get people asking some questions. At least I hope it's enough to get them asking some very basic questions.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
All right, welcome back to the show. Oh, I've got so much fun and games ahead of us. Before I go there, though, let me start by thanking lifesavingfood.com for being one of my sponsors. Yes, we're talking about food storage as well as other preparedness and survival items. I know that this is a time where there's a great deal of uncertainty and people are like, now, come on, quit playing on my fears. Don't make me scared of whatever's coming. I don't know what's coming, but I see a lot of things forming up to, at the very least, make things complicated and probably quite difficult for a lot of us, if not most of us, in the near-term future. And part of it has to do with fallout from the lockdowns. Part of it has to do with choke points in the supply chains. And right now, it looks like there is a food shortage that is being engineered, and we're all going to get real informed about it in another few months. Maybe consider having a few things on hand. Maybe consider having a lot of things on hand. Life-Saving Food is there to help you. They'll ship it right to your door. But that window of opportunity, it's closing. And there's going to come a point where it's going to slam shut when everybody realizes, holy cow, we're in trouble. Please be someone who takes action before that time. Click on the link I provide in my show notes. They can take it from there. Well, here's another take on the likely overturning of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court. It's from El Gato Malo. And El Gato Malo says it's time to row the court out of the business of determining societal mores and morality. Thought this was a good take. El Gato Malo says, I promised you more controversy. Well, here it is. If this makes you mad, just remember, reasonable people can disagree and still be friends. All ideas can be discussed, and any idea that cannot is a problem in and of itself. And it's certainly not going to get solved. The third rail is live. Dinner is served. And I like this warning, and this is an unsafe space. Now, El Gato Malo actually has this slide that says, Gato's Third Rail Diner, and the truth will get you fleas. Okay, well, let's dive right in. El Gato Malo says, as you likely heard, a draft of the majority opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court on overturning Roe v. Wade has leaked. The stakes on this are very high, and abortion is one of the most loaded topics in U.S. politics. It's going to be an epic round of high hypocrisy jersey changes and instant moral inversions of whose body is whose choice. The misrepresentation and recrimination will get aggressive to the point of frantic fabulism. The salience of the matter, what happened, what anything actually means, and basic discernment will all go begging. In other words, this is going to be a mess. And the simple fact is that few here even know the simple facts, much less the complex contexts. So, for instance, here's a tweet from Alexandra De Sanctis Mar. It says, it's in response to a New York Times article, progressive lawmakers across Europe expressed concerns and surprise that the U.S. Supreme Court had privately voted to strike down Roe v. Wade. It would be a terrible regression for American women, one French senator said. Alexandra De Sanctis Mar responds saying, 39 of the 42 European countries that allow elective abortion permitted only in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. Huh, did you know that? Well, now you do. And El Gato Malo says, this is why you can't trust any of these people with choices of this convolution and magnitude. They're politicians and they're pundits. What did you expect? Theirs is the predictable and inevitable twaddle and self-contradiction of those who reason not from precept or from ideals, but from positions for which they then make up tactical pretext. If we want solutions instead of slap fights, well, we need to take this upon ourselves. So rather than become lost in the rapid side shifting of the food fight, we should keep sight of the bigger picture, and that requires acknowledging something. You ready for this? The Alito opinion is actually quite a good decision. In fact, there's a link. You can read it in its entirety. But El Gato Malo says, let's be very clear. I say this not to take a position on abortion. I say this to take a position on the role of the judiciary, and that's a topic we really do need to address. I say this because Roe v. Wade was an awful decision. This was not because of its outcome, over which people can and do disagree and with reason, but because the logic that underpinned it was shoddy and overreaching. And this faulty framing has left an issue of great import in a sort of limbo for generations. So for this reason, I've long said that anyone who is truly pro-choice should want to overturn Roe. It's just a terrible way to establish the boundaries and framework around such a choice. And El Gato Malo says, I am far from alone in this. Even the much vaunted lioness of the left, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, was an outspoken critic of Roe, despite, of course, being strongly pro-choice. She would have preferred that abortion rights be secured more gradually, in a process that included state legislatures and the courts. Ginsburg also was troubled that the focus on Roe was on a right to privacy rather than women's rights. Ginsburg said, Roe isn't really about the woman's choice, is it? It's about the doctor's freedom to practice. It wasn't woman-centered, it was physician-centered. So El Gato Malo says the whole underpinning of the purported right enumerated by Roe is honestly something of a nonsense. The ruling in effect created from whole cloth a positive right to abortion nowhere in evidence in the Constitution by framing it as a sort of far-flung privacy right around doctor-patient interaction, a right clearly trampled in many other places, particularly of late, and one not afforded to other professions. Not only did that constitute the sort of activist court overreach that renders justices constitutional reframers come philosopher kings, but it's an inept framing of the right to boot, and it also finds severe dissonance with the rest of the negative rights-based structure that underpins a republic. So it's not as though making a crime private renders it non-criminal. If a doctor helped a mother kill a three-year-old, would anyone accept this rationale? So a couple of quick quotes here. This right of privacy, whether it be founded in the 14th Amendment's concept of personal liberty and restrictions upon state action as we feel it is, or in the 9th Amendment's reservation of rights to the people, is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether to terminate her pregnancy. This is from Roe, the Roe decision. And also, this quote, the court reasoned that outlawing abortions would infringe a pregnant woman's right to privacy for several reasons. Having unwanted children may force upon the woman a distressful life and future. It may bring imminent psychological harm. Caring for the child may tax the mother's physical and mental health, and because there may be distress for all concerned associated with the unwanted child. End quote. Now, El Gato Malo says, look, this bad, uneasy elucidation has been political pay dirt for 50 years. It's an endless mess, hopelessly insecure, and inconsistent with 30 other areas of law and conscience. So whichever side of the issue you're on, this ruling feels precarious because the purported logic of it is nonsense and it requires some sort of corkscrew reasoning kabuki dance to follow and implement. Both parties love that. The fact that this issue is eternally unstable and could turn on a dime, as perhaps it just did, is a feature. It's not a bug. So watch the current rage and the outlandish exaggeration. This one always brings every bat in the belfry down from the rafters. It's evergreen fundraising fodder and get out the vote gold. So Roe is an awful set of nonsensical and torturous reasoning that sets up ill-established competing interests and never defines any of its key terms. It was a cowardly attempt to reach a desired conclusion while not meaningfully resolving the matter. And whatever your take is on this contentious issue, El Gato Malo says, we have long deserved better. Since 1973, this issue has been deliberately left unsettled and uncertain because it suits the political ends of both parties. So why create a real solution when there's so much ongoing benefit that could be derived from a bad one? We're going to come back and finish up this article from El Gato Malo, including what can we do about it? I hope you'll click on the link and check out the whole article because there are a number of very useful links also contained within it. You can find it in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is The Brian Hyde Show. This is The Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Quick shout out here to the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage. These are your go-to people if you are in need of a mortgage, if you are in need of a VA loan, maybe a reverse mortgage or even a traditional mortgage. Talk to Heather. Whether your loan is needed in Utah or Idaho, she is there to help you along with her team at Patriot Home Mortgage. Heather's NMLS ID is 715386. Her phone number is 435-703-4522. You'll also find an email link provided in my show notes under the sponsors section. Just click on Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage. And yes, Patriot Home Mortgage is an equal housing opportunity lender. So let's talk for just a moment about how we have deserved better in terms of the whole Roe v. Wade decision. I know that it's a hugely contentious issue, but I really enjoy El Gato Malo's take on this. And I have a link to the Boricua Gato Substack. Anyway, you'll find the link in my show notes. And they point out here, the abortion issue has been deliberately left unsettled since 1973. And the political parties, man, they know they can rally their troops. In fact, there's a lot of speculation. This may be what's actually happening. This is to get the left mobilized for the midterms where it looks like they were getting ready to take a shellacking. This is one of those topics that will get people on their feet and out, you know, evangelizing. And as ever, you know, this is a case where a real solution would settle the issue or at least tamp down some of the crazy emotion. But leaving a bad solution in place just creates more political opportunity, more political drama. And as El Gato Malo points out, as ever, we the people get held hostage by the extremist arms of both parties and their corner case competition to hurl moral opprobrium and absolutes because, oh, how the donor money rolls in. But here's the truth of the matter. Most of us don't live there. Most live somewhere in the middle. This is really not all that controversial, but try saying that and see what happens. Here's a tweet from Colin Wright. You know, it's possible to be pro-choice up to a certain point and pro-life beyond a certain point. Pro-choice versus pro-life is a false binary. There, I'm sure that fixes everything, and the responses to this will all be calm and reasonable. Yes, of course, on Twitter, they certainly will. Now, amusingly, this is actually quite similar to what the trimester system in Roe lays out as well. As the widespread European solution, one might think saying so would be somewhat centrist in the Overton window. And mostly, he says, I suspect it is, but the folks on the fringes will never let centrist dialogue occur, so we have no ability to speak calmly or reasonably on this hyper-politicized topic with hair-trigger interest groups diametrically opposed to one another. And it's time we did. So how do we fix it? Well, El Gato Malo says, I see only one way. We have to do what the court failed to and define what a person is. It's that simple, which is to say not simple at all, because there is no objective answer that can be non-dogmatically asserted or proven. But nevertheless, we need to pick one. Now, this is a superlatively messy conversation that's not going to make a lot of very vocal people unhappy. But then these people are happy, but then these people are already unhappy, and the rest are endlessly caught up in their crossfire. So we might as well cowboy up and take a shot at actually resolving the issue for real. Contrary to a lot of ill-informed histrionics, Europe has mostly managed this by finding a societally accepted position and establishing a notion of when life starts. So too can we. Now, Gato Malo says, I'm not going to do that here. I almost did, but honestly, I feel like it would occlude the other point I'm trying to make, which is that we the people and the representatives of our society and mores must step up and shoulder this. I do not want to lose that in the shouting over what the definition could be. But this needs to be our conversation. Punting it to the courts as the unlucky seat in a game of hot potato and then lamenting the courts are dictating our morals to us isn't a valid or viable stance to take. That's crying to mom and then crying because she took your sister's side of the argument. You want it solved? So solve it. We need a solution that takes the real salience into account. It needs to foot and integrate with rules like manslaughter, murder, endangerment, neglect, and 20 other issues. And the only way to do that is to establish rights, who gets them, and when. A person has rights, including the right not to be killed. These are real rights. Foundational rights, which is to say negative rights, the right to be left alone, left unmolested. Now, this conflicts with other such negative rights like self-determination, such as a woman's choice on pregnancy. But unless we're going to go back to allowing infants to be left out for wolves or parents to leave 3-month-old children to starve in a crib because, well, the baby could have gone out for lunch if he was hungry, we're going to need to sort out what gets precedence. I suspect few want to grant a full Spartan-style parental latitude there. If you want to know what that was all about, read about Lycurgus. You'll understand. Now, conversely, unless we're going to start calling having a miscarriage at 10 weeks because you ran a 5K, reckless endangerment and manslaughter, some latitude would seem to be in order. And it's a big question. What duty of care does a parent owe a child and when does this start? Well, Elgato Malo says, let's be clear, this is by no means objective. Many societies, past and present, ascribe no such duty, leaving unwanted or malformed children to die has been historically common or sometimes even socially demanded in many cultures across time. Proving objective rightness here on any given level of duty is probably impossible. The best we can do is say these are the norms and values of our society and social contract. And that brings us back to, so when is an unborn person a person and therefore protected by this social contract as a means to determine whatever duty is owed pertains? Elgato Malo says we need something tangible, well-defined, and deterministic. We need a standard of person about which we can be clear and reasonably unambiguous. We need a point at which human rights accrue to an entity and pass from it as well when determining things like withdrawing life support. Now, no one is saying this is easy. But if all the howling citizens and Congress critters alike really want to solve this issue for good and for all, that's what needs doing. Politicians' self-serving signal failure to do so is what's landed us in a situation like this where one court ruling can have such seismic effects. But of course, we elected them, didn't we? We didn't hold their feet to the fire for a real solution. We let it slide and hoped the duct tape would hold or would give way or whatever your preference was. It was our abrogation of duty over 50 years that set us up for this. And so the court is right to punt this issue back at Congress, the states, and thereby at us. It should never have been decided by judges to begin with. It's neither the place nor the purview of the judiciary to establish our social norms, morals, and mores. Everything that seems like a turn toward a better orientation. By mandate, SCOTUS addresses adherence to the Constitution, defends rights, and limits the government to its enumerated power. In practice, we played the craven and encouraged it to vastly exceed this to push what we feared to legislate. Boy, is that ever true. Let's find a judge who will make this happen for us. But it is left to we the people, not they the judges, to remake the Constitution if such remaking is in order. And Elgato Malo says, I'm not even sure the answer to this question can be legislated. To whom is such power granted, and would we want them to have it if it were? Is this an issue we want up to future majority rule and to remain a hot potato in perpetuity? congressional diktat underwritten by a fragile majority position seems an unsound foundation on which to erect a durable right. If we have to hold a constitutional convention and write a deterministic standard in once and for all, then let's do it. But enough screwing around and avoiding the responsibility. And if you won't stop screwing around, then stop asking me to take seriously how seriously you take this issue. I won't believe you. If this is as important as everyone says it is, then let's settle it. To paraphrase the text of another truly awful ruling that's wreaked untold mischief through legislating from the bench, three generations of imbecility are enough. Now, I, by the way, would not sign on to the idea of, yeah, let's have a constitutional convention once and for all, and we'll write this out and get this thing settled. But I do think that El Gato Malo is right. Let's define what a person is, but let's do it. Let's define this at the lowest possible level instead of the one-size-fits-all approach. I mean, for crying out loud, the hysteria over this. Hillary Clinton yesterday actually was talking about, well, you know, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, you have no idea who they're going to come for next. Where do you hear that kind of language? Who they're going to come for next? Really? Are they coming after somebody? No. They're returning this decision and this authority to make such decisions to the states and the people. But hey, you never know who they're going to come for next. I think she's a little bit worried because John Durham just got some of her papers, and maybe they'll be coming for her next. One can only hope.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I just want to thank SewingAndQuiltingCenter.com. I really appreciate them being a sponsor. I especially appreciated Teresa Alsop coming and joining me on the show the other day. If my demographics read correctly, and I'm not trying to exclude if you're a female listener, generally I find that my main audience is guys. And so I'm going to recommend guys. Sewing may not be one of your interests, but if it is, that doesn't mean you're any kind of a girly man or anything. That just means you have a broad variety of interests. But if you have ever been thinking about, hey, do we need a sewing machine? I'm going to ask you, consider taking your wife to sewingandquiltingcenter.com or, you know, anybody else you want to surprise with something great and pick out a sewing machine. Because they'll not only sell you the very best machines available, and they have everything from entry-level machines up to the very top-of-the-line long-arm quilting machines, but they'll teach you how to use that machine. They'll repair those machines as they need service through the years. And, of course, they have all the supplies to go along with them. That's sewingandquiltingcenter.com, located in St. George, Utah. Give them a try. You'll find a link in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. All right, two quick things here before we wrap this hour up. When you hear people complaining that the overturn of Roe v. Wade spells the end of democracy, Hillary Clinton, I'm looking your direction. Who are they going to come for next? It's not true. And Thomas L. Knapp explains why using democracy as an argument against overturning Roe v. Wade doesn't work. He says, in the wake of a leaked draft Supreme Court opinion, which, if it represents a final vote, would overturn Roe v. Wade, pro-choice advocates are marshaling their best and worst arguments against removing that ruling's protections for abortion. Now, he says, as always, I'll refrain from sharing my own opinions on abortion as such. I'm not interested in convincing anyone of anything there for no other reason that I'm not firmly convinced myself. But he says, I won't refrain from sharing my opinions on poor arguments, though. Both in general and on abortion specifically, they're quite possibly my top pet peeve. And he says, the worst argument I'm hearing right now is, the envelope please, overturning Roe would be undemocratic. Now he's quoting Ben Beckett, writing at Jacobin magazine. Overturning Roe v. Wade shows the right has nothing but contempt for democracy. Ben Beckett writes, if the decision stands, it will be a high water mark for the right's project of undemocratic rule. As the draft decision shows, the Supreme Court is arguably the most powerful weapon the right has for ruling without and against the people. End quote. Now, Thomas L. Knapp says, really? The problem isn't a matter of fundamental individual rights versus state power, but rather of democracy? He says, let's take a look at the three underlying cases. In Roe v. Wade, 1973, the Supreme Court overturned Articles 1191, 1194, and 1196 of Texas's Penal Code. Those articles in the code, and that code rather, were passed by a democratically elected state legislature. The court overturned democracy in favor of what it held was a constitutionally protected individual right. In Planned Parenthood v. Casey, 1992, the court further expanded its interpretation of those constitutional protections versus Pennsylvania's Abortion Control Act of 1982, once again ruling against a democratically elected state legislature and in favor of a right to abortion. And in the current case, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Association, the court will rule either for or against Mississippi's Gestational Age Act, which, you guessed it, was passed by a democratically elected state legislature. So if the draft opinion becomes an actual ruling, democratically elected state legislatures will once again make decisions on abortion law. In other words, that's the exact opposite of undemocratic. It's full-blown democracy, tiptoeing through the abortion tulips with bells on and playing a ukulele. He says those who consider a constitutional right to abortion might want to reconsider their fetishistic and, in this case, simply incorrect appeals to democracy. There's something to be said for protection of individual rights against the whim of majorities, and not only on this issue. That's actually a really solid observation. All right, one final story I wanted to share with you. 2020, I think, is going to be a year that's going to be studied by historians for ages to come, just because it was such a bizarre year. None of us, I mean, we're still pretty close to it, so we probably don't see the forest for the trees, but it'll be interesting to see how the history books are written as time goes on. I like this article from Janet Levy. The real black swan event of 2020 was not the virus. She says it was the assault on small business. Janet Levy says most people believe the coronavirus was a black swan, meaning an unexpected event of large magnitude with unprecedented consequences. But Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who coined that metaphor, disagrees. Coronaviruses were well known, though the SARS-CoV-2 strain that hit humans was new. And the pandemic wasn't unexpected. Experts had been warning of one, though not of the coronavirus per se, for years. In 2019, the government had conducted months-long pandemic preparation drills. Taleb's annoyance is at the diminution of his coinage to a cliché. But there was, however, a real black swan event in 2020, says Carol Roth in her book, The War on Small Business: How Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. It was the U.S. government's reaction to the pandemic, with unprecedented decisions and a lockdown that forced people to stop working and doing business for months on end. The pandemic became a pretext for a politically motivated campaign against small business and individuals to hasten the consolidation of power in big business, big tech, and big government. That's the hook and the weighty claim with which Roth begins her book. Now, Carol Roth is a recovering investment banker, and that's important because she has seen how Wall Street undermines Main Street by working with government through lobbyists and lawyers. So her book explores two big ideas. First, that the ills of capitalism, the concentration of immense wealth in a few individuals, for example, cannot be cured by central planning or more government, because the real problem is the government. Second, the more government has tried to protect us from the big, bad, wolf-esque corporations, the more powerful those corporations have grown. And this happens because central planning is all about control. A few powerful figures, reminiscent of the cliques and nomenclature of the Soviet Union, decide on everything. And since control of a few is easier, small businesses, competitive, resolute, and representing the true independent spirit of capitalism, must be broken. So the battle for power and control, Roth stresses, is the background against which readers should see her tour horizon for the impact of a tour de horizon of the impact of the pandemic response. A well-established system of cronyism, the very antithesis of testing business ideas in the market, has been hell-bent on killing small businesses, individual rights, and ultimately freedom. It did not waste the opportunity it saw in the 15 days to flatten the curve, which dragged on to almost a year and crushed hundreds of thousands of small businesses. In fact, Roth says it ensured that government declared war on small business while doing everything to favor big business. Now, Roth points out several biased inconsistencies in lockdown rules. For instance, large corporations never shuttered. In fact, they prospered during the year. The government allowed large box retailers to remain open, while smaller stores, possibly environs of lesser ineffectivity, were penalized for opening. The book reports on fighters like Shelley Luther of Dallas, Texas, who went to jail for keeping her salon open, though she maintained strict safety protocols. Driven to desperation, she and her staff had decided to work. "Feeding my kids is not selfish," she told the judge. "If you think the law is more important than getting kids fed, then please go ahead with your decision, but I'm not going to shut the salon." Through examples like Luther's, this book raises a lot of questions. For instance, why should a large pet store that grooms dogs be open while nail salons were ordered shut? How could businesses that sold alcohol and marijuana be declared essential? Why close houses of worship or limit the number of worshipers when more people could gather in large grocery stores? How could left-wing Antifa and BLM protests, where demonstrators violated masking and social distancing rules and turned violent, be granted permission? Why did police hold back when these protesters looted, vandalized, or set fire to small businesses? These are fair questions. I have a link to the article. You can check it out in its entirety. I hope it will make some sense and maybe vindicate some of the things you've already been thinking about this. But that is the true tragedy of 2020. And what's happened to small business? Well, we're beginning to see some of the effects. We're beginning to reap some of the consequences. And it's not pretty. And I don't mean to end on an optimistic note, but it's probably going to get tougher before it gets better. All the more reason to own your worldview, stay informed, and be more certain of who you are and what you stand for than simply what you're against.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.